Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lisa Hajar, professor of sociology at the University of California, who examines the role of Egypt's new vice president, Omar Suleiman, in cooperating with U.S. rendition programs and the torture of prisoners. Gada Talhami, professor of politics emerita at Lake Forest College, who assesses Egypt's future relationship with Israel after President Hosni Mubarak leaves office under pressure from a popular uprising. And Mary Bokhtari, director of the Real Economy Project, who takes a critical look at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report and the work that still needs to be done to prevent future economic meltdowns. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human rights monitors are raising serious concerns about the detention of U.S. Army private Bradley Manning, WikiLeaks' alleged source for leaked U.S. government documents. The United Nations Special Rapporteur for Torture has reportedly opened an inquiry into the Manning case. According to The Nation magazine, Manning's indefinite detention has sharpened the focus on the harsh conditions endured by terror suspects in American jails. Critical details about Manning's confinement are being circulated by his lawyer David Combs and MIT researcher David House, a founder of the Bradley Manning Support Committee. Since 9/11, a growing number of terror suspects, mostly Muslims, are held in solitary confinement under the government's Special Administrative Measures powers. In addition, a suspect's family and lawyer risk prosecution if they disclose any details of conversations with a terror-related detainee. Human rights activists say U.S. treatment of detainees alleged to be security risks is impeding international cooperation on terrorism. Last year, the European Court of Human Rights held up the extradition to the U.S. of four suspected terrorists because of the harsh conditions for terror suspects in American prisons. In a new twist, the Justice Department has recently negotiated a number of plea bargains with detainees considered to be security risks and held in solitary confinement. The Los Angeles Times reports that guns purchased in Arizona were smuggled to Mexican drug gangs and then used in a mid-December shootout that killed U.S. Border Control agent Brian Terry. Two AK-47s used in the firefight against Border Control agents in southern Arizona were purchased from a gun dealer in Glendale, Arizona, in January 2010, and subsequently tracked by the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF. Congress has opened an investigation to see if the ATF failed to seize the weapons it was tracking before the guns fell into the hands of the Mexican drug traffickers. In Phoenix, federal prosecutors recently announced the indictment of 34 people charged with acting as straw purchasers of guns, mostly for the Sinaloa drug cartel, which was implicated in the shootout with U.S. Border Control agents in December. The Obama White House's new overture to corporate America has come with the sacrifice of tougher worker safety standards. In early February, the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, indefinitely delayed implementation of a proposed rule on ergonomic injuries such as carpal tunnel syndrome and strained backs. In a press release, OSHA Agency Director David Michaels declared, "It is clear the proposal has raised concerns among small businesses, so OSHA is facilitating an active dialogue between the agency and the small business community." According to the news magazine In These Times, the proposed rules would require firms to provide statistical data to OSHA on ergonomic injuries, also known as musculoskeletal disorder injuries. This was seen as a less burdensome requirement than the Clinton-era ergonomic rule, which was overturned by a Republican Congress in 2001. OSHA may have acted to preempt an investigation by California Congressman Darrell Issa, who now chairs the House Oversight Committee. Issa had signaled that he intended to launch a probe into new worker safety rules. Peg Seminario, head of the AFL-CIO's Worker Safety Division, lamented, "Just because the Chamber of Commerce and other business groups scream doesn't mean there is a legitimate reason for retreat." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After almost 3 weeks of intense street protests in Egypt demanding the removal of President Hosni Mubarak from power, more than 300 people were reported to have died in clashes between demonstrators, police, and government supporters. Despite concessions, such as Mubarak's pledge not to run in the presidential election scheduled for September and constitutional reform, the number of protesters in Tahrir Square in central Cairo swelled on February 8th. On that day, the crowd welcomed as a hero Wael Ghanem, a Google executive who had set up a Facebook page that many credit with inspiring the massive protests, after he was freed from 12 days in jail. 4 days after the protests began, embattled President Mubarak appointed Omar Suleiman as his vice president, a man who had served as chief of Egypt's General Intelligence Service since 1993. A Mubarak loyalist, Suleiman has taken a leading role in the government's attempt to negotiate with Egypt's diverse civil society groups, demanding Mubarak's immediate removal from office. Suleiman has met with representatives of the opposition to launch committees tasked with proposing constitutional reforms and a timetable for a peaceful transfer of power. But there are many questions about the role Suleiman has played in the Mubarak regime. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Lisa Hajar, associate professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She discusses her recent article, Suleiman, the CIA's Man in Cairo and Egypt's Torturer-in-Chief, which looks at Suleiman's cooperation with the United States' rendition of terrorist suspects to Egypt under the Clinton administration to host 9/11 charges of Egyptian torture by proxy under President Bush.
The two people who have long been considered rivals to succeed Mubarak were Mubarak's own son, Gamal, who Hosni was grooming, but also Suleiman. And so when Mubarak, you know, appointed Suleiman as his vice president, you know, filling a position that had literally been empty for the 30 years of Mubarak's dictatorship, it signaled that Mubarak had read the tea leaves and his own son was out. And over this past week, you see Gamal now is totally out of the picture. By appointing Suleiman, it was a very shrewd move on Mubarak's part because he knew that America knows Suleiman, at least American administrators, you know, political leaders in Washington and the neocons who are very influential in America. And appointing Suleiman would assuage Israeli anxieties because he's also known to be, you know, someone who's ardently committed to maintaining the peace treaty with Egypt.
Lisa, you write in your recent article about Suleiman's direct involvement in the U.S. rendition program,
right,
dating back even to the Clinton administration, and then a more direct role in the extraordinary renditions that were authorized by President Bush after the 9/11 attacks.
Yes. In the mid-1990s, the rendition program was actually developed under Clinton, although what distinguishes rendition from extraordinary rendition is that regular rendition means kidnapping people, usually by the CIA or perhaps in collusion with other security services, kidnapping people and then transporting them somewhere to a country where they can be tried. Even as the program was being devised under Clinton, they had to, you know, work in close cahoots with other governments, and Egypt was the country of choice, and Suleiman was the person. After 9/11, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, I mean, it was on September 16, 2001, when Bush authorizes the CIA to engage in, you know, what now becomes extraordinary rendition, which is kidnapping people and either disappearing them into CIA black sites or transporting them for torture by proxy to third countries. You know, Egypt became a very significant, although certainly not the only site, where people would be rendered into. And so Suleiman was actively involved in that. I mean, there were probably dozens of people who were kidnapped or captured by the CIA or turned over to the CIA, rendered into Egypt for torture, sometimes rendered back to American custody, sometimes ending up in Guantanamo or, you know, whatever might happen.
What's amazing about your article is that you talk about newly appointed Egyptian Vice President Suleiman's direct involvement in torture, participation in torturing prisoners. Tell us about that.
The two cases that I highlight in the article, one of them is someone named Mamadou Habib. And Habib ultimately, as you know, was an Egyptian-born Australian citizen, in retrospect, entirely innocent. I mean, entirely like sort of wrong guy picked up, et cetera. So Habib was arrested in Pakistan, tortured at Americans' behest by the Pakistanis, ultimately because he was an Egyptian national, or, you know, had been Egyptian-born, rather, was sent off to Cairo. He was being beaten and electrocuted and hung, you know, by his wrists and so on. At one point, the person who was tormenting him slapped him so hard that his blindfold dislodged and he could see who it was, and it was Suleiman himself. So Suleiman was personally torturing Habib, and Suleiman was frustrated that he wasn't confessing to some involvement with torture or giving intelligence, and so he ordered a guard there in the interrogation location to essentially kill another prisoner in order to, you know, sort of force to break Habib. And so the guard then, you know, gave a brutal karate kick and actually killed a Turkestani prisoner who was chained right beside Habib. Perhaps, though, if there was one single episode of torture that has had unparalleled global ramifications, it was the torture in Egypt of Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, who was a Libyan who probably was affiliated with the Taliban, picked up by the Pakistanis in 2001, sent off to Egypt. And so during the period in the fall and winter of 2002-2003, before the invasion, both the CIA and the military were under intense pressure to produce information, i.e. confessions, that would somehow be proof of the suspected al-Qaeda Saddam Hussein connection. And in fact, it was under torture in Egypt, under Suleiman's, you know, authority, that Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, quote, confessed to the fact that two al-Qaeda operatives had gone into Iraq to be trained in the use of chemical and biological weapons. And that was the one of the two pieces of evidence that former, you know, Secretary of State Colin Powell presented to the United Nations to make the case for war, the sort of the proof that there was, in fact, a Saddam connection to 9/11. So the war begins, and after that, you know, Ibn Sheikh al-Libi basically retracts what he had said, because, in fact, he'd only said it under torture. And so one can say that the Iraq war, the thousands of American lives, the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives, the trillions of dollars that have been spent were built on a tortured lie that was actually pursued by the United States with the direct collusion of Egypt, and specifically with Omar Suleiman.
That was Lisa Hajar, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Read her article, Suleiman, the CIA's Man in Cairo and Egypt's Torturer-in-Chief, at the website she co-edits, jadalia.com. The question of how the popular uprising in Egypt will affect the liberation struggle of the Palestinian people is one of great concern in the U.S. as well as in the Middle East. The Camp David Peace Accords were signed in 1978 by Menachem Begin of Israel and Anwar Sadat of Egypt, who was assassinated 3 years later. For the past 30 years, under Hosni Mubarak, Egypt has collaborated with Israel to seal off the 1.5 million Palestinians living in Gaza and has been Israel's most powerful Arab ally. Now, as angry street protests across Egypt demand the ouster of Mubarak, there have been reports of gun battles between Egyptian security forces and Islamist Bedouin groups near Egypt's border with Hamas-controlled Gaza, as well as the bombing of a northern Sinai gas terminal, which briefly interrupted gas exports to Israel and Jordan. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Gada Talhami, Professor Emerita in the Department of Politics at Lake Forest College near Chicago, where she has taught for 25 years. A Palestinian, Talhami has written 4 books about Egypt and 1 on the Palestinian refugee issue. She says the crisis in Egypt is not just about democracy, but one of illegitimacy, largely due to the Egyptian public's negative view of their government's relationship with Israel.
Since 1979, the Israelis were able to fight several wars, and they admit this today, based on the fact that they are assured of the silence and the inactivity of the Egyptian military. Given the temper of the Egyptian public, given now years and years and years of critiquing this relationship in the press, because they really achieved something remarkable, the Egyptian public has managed to achieve a cold peace. The public itself has defied the normalization of relations that was to be one aspect of the Camp David Agreement. And the government went along, of course, playing as they wish, being the great allies of the United States, which means giving full support to Israeli policies all these years.
The uprising has not been led by the Muslim Brotherhood, yet that's the group that the U.S. government is always saying is the alternative to Mubarak. Where do they stand on this issue?
They have always advocated closer relationship with the Arab and Muslim world, and they have always criticized Egypt in particular for weakening the ties with the Arab and Muslim publics, particularly with the Muslim movement in Gaza. Everybody would agree that what the Mubarak regime is suffering from is really a crisis of delegitimization more than anything else. It's not only a crisis of democracy. It is the fact that over the 30 years, the Mubarak regime has lost its legitimacy in the eyes of its public to a great degree because of its inability to affect any kind of change in the Israeli-Egyptian relationship.
So, do you think Hosni Mubarak is just a hapless puppet of the United States? What did Egypt, under Hosni Mubarak, get out of the Camp David Accords for 30 years?
Well, they got Israel's neutrality. They didn't get back Sinai because Sinai actually has been demilitarized. There are no Egyptian troops in Sinai. There are international troops. And only belatedly, within this last few years, the Egyptians have been brought into the equation over Gaza by literally doing what the Israelis wanted them to do, which is to stop the Gazan people from escaping through the Egyptian boundary. So now we see the Egyptians engage in the bizarre project of building a wall, a cement wall, in order to shut off Gaza from Egypt. That does not sit well with the Egyptian public. This has been all over the years. What did they get out of it? A great deal of gratitude by the United States, particularly during the Bush administration. And that's why you hear the rhetoric all the time of Egypt is our great ally, Egypt is our great ally. As long as Egypt was willing to prevent itself from doing anything to shake up the Israeli situation, the United States was happy. The United States has given its full support, particularly under the Bush administration, to whatever the Israelis were doing. So that translated in really an erosion in the credibility and the legitimacy of the Mubarak regime, particularly in Egypt. I mean, we can say that it doesn't matter how Arabs feel about this. What you should really remember is how Egyptians feel about this. They have been really angry at this kind of one-sided, imbalanced relationship between the two countries.
We here in the U.S. hear that Egypt is an ally because it has made a peace treaty with Israel. What impact do you think the uprising in Egypt will have on the Israel-Palestine question?
I don't think the Netanyahu administration will move one inch towards going back to the negotiations with the Palestinians. But I think pressure from the Egyptians, if there is going to be a change of regime, as we hope will be, and if there is going to be a serious reevaluation of Egyptian foreign policy in the region, one aspect of it will be that the Egyptians will even freeze the relationship more with Israel. For instance, no gas, no free gas to the Israelis. Perhaps the Egyptians will withdraw their ambassador whenever the Israelis increase the building of illegal settlements, when the Israelis continue to expel Arab families from their homes in East Jerusalem. That has been a terrible event that's going on all the time, and the Egyptians just look the other way. Egypt would simply have to be more proactive in this kind of relationship.
Do you think that Israel has a right to exist?
Of course I do. I'm a realist. It has existed. It was established by illegitimate means, in my opinion. It has been established in the throes of the post-Cold War period, when everybody were sympathetic to the plight of the European Jewish community, forgetting completely that the Palestinians have nothing to do with the German policy during that period. How do you deal with it? Do you simply allow it to continue to expand, continue to take over Palestinian land, continue to reduce the Palestinian territories to Bantustan, continue to starve the people of Gaza? No. There's other policies, short of war. And other policies short of war will have to be extreme diplomatic, economic, and political pressure.
That was Ghada Talhami, professor of politics emerita at Lake Forest College. She is the author of The Mobilization of Muslim Women in Egypt, published by University Press of Florida. the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, made up of 6 Democrats, 4 Republicans, and chaired by former California State Treasurer Phil Angelides, was formed in 2009 by Congress and tasked with examining the domestic and global causes of the U.S. financial and economic crises. On January 27th, the bipartisan commission released its 633-page final report, where a majority on the panel concluded that the financial meltdown could have been avoided and was the result of poor decision-making both in government and at top Wall Street and financial firms that fostered a culture of excessive risk-taking. The report includes dissenting opinions by Republican members who argued that government housing programs, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, were to blame for the crisis by setting off the subprime lending boom when they promoted home ownership to unqualified borrowers. The commission, which was not given the responsibility for offering policy recommendations, has been criticized for not dealing forcefully with the campaign finance system, which led to irresponsible deregulation and the lack of accountability for Wall Street bankers who triggered the financial meltdown. Unlike criminal probes after the Great Depression and the savings and loan banking scandal in the 1980s, to date, no prosecutions have been initiated against financiers whose reckless behavior left 24 million Americans unemployed and 4 million foreclosed homes. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mary Buttari, director of the Real Economy Project at the Center for Media and Democracy, who takes a critical look at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report and the work that still needs to be done to prevent future economic meltdowns.
What's so interesting about the conclusions is that, on the one hand, the information isn't new. So, for instance, you know, the Federal Reserve could have done something to crack down on mortgage abuses and predatory lending when these practices were first brought to their attention is not a new conclusion. But to have it out there and to name some of the key moments of deregulation and missed opportunity, you know, like the SEC should have required more capital and they shouldn't have let the investment banks get away with these incredible leverage limits in 2002, somehow telling these truths is now a radical act in Washington, D.C., because as soon as the report was released, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce went ballistic and blamed the commission for an abuse of the process and for becoming WikiLeakers by actually daring to put the real documents, the real emails, the real interview transcripts up on the Internet.
From what I've been reading, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, there has been nobody on Wall Street, none of these banking corporations, has been sent to jail for their reckless behavior, which has certainly cost many people their small fortunes and their large fortunes. Unlike back in the 1930s during the Depression, there were bankers and Wall Street con artists who did go to jail. And the same thing in the scandal of the savings and loan banks back in the 1980s. There were prosecutions. Tell us from where you sit, why we haven't seen any accountability in what everybody is saying is, of course, the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression.
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. Not a single CEO, one of these big mortgage firms like Ameriquest or Countrywide or those kinds of firms, or one of the big banks, has been prosecuted and sent to jail. The only successful Wall Street prosecutions so far have been for Ponzi schemes, Bernie Madoff and Jim Stanford down in Florida. But back in the S&O crisis, there were 1,500 prosecutions of top officers. 1,000 people went to jail. 500 of them were CEOs. I mean, that's a pretty nice track record. And they were small SNLs scattered across the United States. They didn't have the type of concentrated wealth and power and political might that the Wall Street firms have. And Congress played a really active role in the whole SNL crisis. I mean, the hearings that Congress had into the SNL crisis, and they would call the regulators in front of them, they would call the SNL leaders in front of them, and they would push the regulators, they would push the FDIC and the SEC to do a better job and to investigate further and to do more, and they'd pound on the table. Well, that didn't happen in this instance. Neither the regulators nor Congress really did their due diligence in pushing for these types of prosecutions. And there was no money made available like there was in the SNL crisis. And if you were a cynical person, you might think it has something to do with the fact that Wall Street is one of the largest contributors to Congress that we have.
Well, Mary, as we conclude here, what's your assessment of the congressional financial regulation reform legislation that was passed? Certainly there are many people who have criticized it as too weak, that it won't prevent the whole too-big-to-fail syndrome and some of these big institutions that may find themselves doing similar acts of recklessness in the future. If you were to go back to the drawing board on financial regulation reform, where would you go?
Well, to my mind, the single most important issue is the issue of too-big-to-fail. The six largest banks right now, their assets are worth 64% of GDP. That's how big they are. Okay, Bank of America, its assets are worth or comparable to 16% of GDP. If one of these institutions goes down, it poses a huge risk to the system. And they didn't get smaller during the course of the financial crisis. They got larger. So I think only 17 years ago, that number wasn't 64%. It was under 50%. So we still have these behemoth institutions. The taxpayers are still backing up their risky behavior. We didn't separate the bank from the casino, although we tried very hard. So this issue of too big to fail has not been solved. It's still out there. And Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, which is perhaps the United States' largest bank, promises a financial crisis every 5 to 7 years, he says. And so it may take another one of these for us to get the type of reform that we really need.
That was Mary Batari, director of the Real Economy Project at the Center for Media and Democracy. Contact the project by calling area code 608-260-9713 or visit their website at banksterusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.